Hey, everybody. This is the Between the Ropes podcast. I'm Brian Fritz. Appreciate you listening in, for subscribing, for downloading the Between the Ropes podcast. So many different places where you can get it. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, and on SoundCloud as well. So please make sure that you subscribe to the podcast. You never know when we're going to have a new one out. Now, Michael Wiseman and I, we do our regular podcast each week talking about the latest going on in the wrestling business. That will be out this week on Wednesday night. So we'll have more going on with WWE, of course, on the road to WrestleMania. And anything else that's going on in the wrestling business that we find interesting that we want to discuss. But you never know when another Between the Ropes podcast is going to show up because of an interview that I've gotten. Now, I hope that you got to check out the recent podcast I did with Bruce Pritchard, formerly of WWE. Of course, Bruce worked in the wrestling business for over four decades, and he spent 22 years as Vince McMahon's right-hand man working in WWE. He has a ton of knowledge and a lot of stories as well, and he's having a lot of success with his Something to Wrestle With podcast, part of MLW Radio. So I hope you got an opportunity to check out the podcast that I did with Bruce. Lots of stories, lots of discussion there. Now, another podcast over at MLW that's doing very well in its early infancy is What Happened When. And that podcast features Tony Schiavone, the longtime voice for the NWA, for WCW. He had a very, very brief run with the WWF, just a year. But Tony was a longtime wrestler, and for a lot of us, he was one of the original voices that we grew up with when it comes to the wrestling business. I know I am one of those people that grew up with Tony Schiavone as a big part of my life when it came to enjoying wrestling, because growing up in Florida, I remember 6:05 Saturday nights, like so many people, appointment television on the Superstation WTBS. You had to get home, and there was Tony Schiavone and getting ready to call NWA action with the World Championship Wrestling show, and so many different great, you know, things that happened on that show. And now all of that's available on the WWE Network, or they keep adding more and more on there. But these classic angles, but especially classic promos on there. Because each week, man, there's so many different colorful people. You get Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen, Magnum TA, Dusty Rhodes, the Road Warriors, the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express, Nikita Koloff. I mean, there's just tons and tons of guys that were on there. And that was the wrestling that I grew up with, being a teenager at that time, you know, in the mid-80s, and being able to enjoy that. So Tony Schiavone was one of the original voices that I always equated to when it came to wrestling. And then as his career continued, obviously, with WCW, big part of the Monday Night Wars going on between WCW and the WWF at the time. So Tony has had a long, distinguished career when it comes to wrestling broadcasting. When WCW folded and he did not get offered a job by Vince McMahon, he got out of the wrestling business. And, you know, that was a time that, you know, the last couple of years were difficult time for him and a lot of other people working through WCW as it was going out of business. But Tony just made a clean break and really has not done anything in wrestling until just a couple of years ago. It wasn't too long ago where Tony had agreed to do a wrestling convention, and he's done a couple, but he's seen the amount of attention that he has gotten and how much fans love Tony Schiavone and how much support that they have for him. And he has a lot of stories. He has a lot of knowledge, and you know, he's still been working in broadcast, just not in the wrestling business. He's just been doing it when it comes to sports, doing things with the Georgia Bulldogs and the Gwinnett Braves, which is a minor league baseball team, working with a sports station in Atlanta. And he got convinced to talk about wrestling again and even start watching wrestling a little bit again. And so now he is doing the podcast at MLW Radio, the What Happened With podcast that drops every Monday, where he can tell so many different stories and talk about different events that took place during his broadcasting career. And it's great to hear Tony again, just because he has so many different stories and so much knowledge of being in the wrestling business at that time. And, you know, I know some people have given him grief because they think that Tony just doesn't like wrestling anymore. And that's not true. Tony still loves wrestling. It's just that he has other priorities in his life when it comes to his work, his career, his family. And he's getting back into it now, though, because he has this great opportunity with the podcast, and it's taken off. It's doing very well so far, which is fantastic to hear. And I got an opportunity to talk to Tony as we discussed the podcast and some of his stories and recollections. And like I said, there's going to be plenty of that he's going to be covering in his own podcast. But I got the opportunity to talk to him recently, and it was great, you know, being able to speak with somebody that I grew up with. And I have so many fond memories of, you know, watching, especially as a teenager. And even as I got older, you know, watching him voice WCW. So let me get to it right now. Here is my conversation with Tony Schiavone. He is Tony Schiavone, the longtime NWA and WCW announcer. Now he's back in your wrestling world. That's because his new podcast, What Happened When, drops every Monday, part of MLW Radio. Tony, thanks for the time. Appreciate you coming on here.
Thanks, Brian. I never thought I would get back into it, but here I am again, and it's been overwhelming. In just a couple of weeks, we've done quite well, and we're very excited about our podcast and very excited about the reception from everyone out there.
The wrestling world clamoring for Tony Schiavone back in their lives.
Wow. Wow. Can't believe it. Still don't believe it. You know, right at the end there, there's probably a whole cadre of people who wouldn't give you a plug nickel for Tony Schiavone. But, you know, I know how it is with nostalgia now. People like to remember back at the good old times. And I'm glad I was part of the good old times, even before the Nitro and how hot we were back in the old 80s with Jim Crockett Promotions.
See, that's where I got to know you a lot, because I started watching wrestling when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old, and Saturday night at 6:05, that was a time where everything else in the world stopped, and you got home and you turned on the Superstation so you could see Tony Schiavone and, you know, World Championship Wrestling from the NWA days. I mean, that was appointment television for so many people. Did you realize at the time, like, how big of a thing that was, especially for that time period?
I think so. And the reason I think so is because I used to watch it. And I used to watch Gordon Solie, and I was a big fan, and I knew how big of a deal it was. And it was just an exciting time to watch wrestling. I was just like you. I was just like everybody else. I was watching, you know, World Championship Wrestling and Gordon Solie and I guess Roddy Piper with him for a little while, and all the stars they had then. And when I finally got a chance in April of 85 to do it, I realized how big of a deal this was, only because I had been a wrestling fan before.
Yeah, and I think that because you grew up watching Mid-Atlantic, correct?
Right, that's correct, yeah.
And sure did. And to be a wrestling fan and to get in, how exactly did you get your first opportunity to get into it?
I was, when I got out of college, I got a job in Greensboro, North Carolina, doing play-by-play for the Greensboro Hornets. And they were in the South Atlantic League, and they were the Yankees single-A team. I spent a year there. And after the season was over, a friend of mine told me that the Charlotte job was open. That was the double-A team of the Orioles. So I applied for it, and I drove from Greensboro down to Charlotte and met with, believe it or not, Frances Crockett. Now, I knew Frances Crockett because I had followed baseball. She was, like, named Executive of the Year by the Sporting News. Minor League Executive of the Year, I think, one year. I knew she was in it, and I knew she would ran the team, so I was very excited to meet her. She hired me that day, and from that day until, and that was 82, the off season of 82. It could have been like November of 82, or it could have been like November of 81 or the springtime of 82. My wife and I moved down to Charlotte. And from that moment on until I started doing wrestling, I don't know if pestering is the right word, but I kept telling Frances, I said, you know, I can do wrestling. If your brothers ever need anything, and her brothers ran wrestling, she didn't. If your brothers ever need somebody to do something, even a part-time basis, Frances, I can do it. And I let her know a lot. And one day in 83, she called me into the office after we were out making sales calls. Job in minor league baseball back then was pretty tough. Didn't make much money. You worked long hours, did a lot of sales work. So anyway, she brought me into the office and said, okay, my brother said they'd like to use you on one thing, and that is to go to Ric Flair's house and interview him about a new event called Starcade a flair for the gold where he's going to wrestle Harley Race. Well, I flipped out because I'd watched Ric Flair for years. And I remember that night very, very vividly, not being able to sleep that night because I was going to meet Ric Flair. So I did it. Flair liked it. He liked what I did. He told Jimmy Crockett, this kid's pretty good. And then a week later, she said, okay, they want to use you to go to the studios, which were these little makeshift studios they had in the garage, but it worked. And they want you to do the local interviews. And that's back when we would insert local interviews, one with a heel, one with a baby face, in every local show, promoting the Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling events coming to your area. So I would interview wrestlers. So that's how it started. And I remember Frances telling me, she said, you're going to get caught in the middle between your obligations to me in baseball and wrestling wanting more and more of you. It's going to be tough. And she was right, because she would want me to do this, and I would go down and do wrestling on Wednesdays. But it kind of worked out that I started working for the Crockett family in baseball, and it became a wrestling venture, you know, later, a couple of years later. By 1985 was my last year doing the Charlotte team. I was doing both. And after that 1985 season, Jimmy said, just come work for us full time. So that's where it started there.
Was there any thought at the time of saying, you know what, maybe I should stick with baseball?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of thought about that. Because that was my love. That was my ambition, was to be a Major League Baseball announcer. By 85, we had two kids and one on the way, and baseball wasn't paying anything. And I was making more part-time in wrestling than I was full-time in baseball. So I started working for wrestling and made a lot more money. Now, I still didn't make much money. I really didn't make good money until the TBS days, until TBS bought the company. But I couldn't survive on baseball, and I had a family. Had it been just me by myself, no wife, no family, maybe I would have stayed with baseball. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And to think about that time then, because like we said, you know, for so many people, 6:05 Saturday night Superstation, that was appointment television. And to see what you guys were doing at the time, was there a particular period where you thought, hey, this is catching on? There are people that are really going out of their way and noticing what we're doing here and making sure that they're all watching at the same time and catching on with what we're doing.
Yeah, I think it was. I think we knew that at the first Starcade, and I think we knew that at the first couple of Starcades when we would simulcast Starcade from Atlanta and Greensboro, you'll recall, and we would sell out both, and we'd also have closed circuit TVs put up in other arenas as well, other arenas around the Mid-Atlantic territory like Fayetteville, Columbia, South Carolina. And then when we started on TBS in 85, and then we started to go national, and we started to go with the Great American Bash. Now, some of that original Bash tour, some of those venues were not that good for us. So I'm not here to say that, oh, the Great American Bash sold out everywhere, because it didn't. But the place that we did well, like Philadelphia, Cincinnati, Atlanta, Greensboro, Charlotte, those places told us that we had quite a following nationwide.
Yeah. You guys definitely had your wheelhouse of where you knew like fans are going to be rabid here and they're going to come on droves for the product that we're doing. And at the time, I mean, that was, you know, when you talk about national stuff and you have WWF at the time and they're growing into this national thing, but their product was so dynamically different from what you guys were doing. What was the thought then about what they were doing product-wise compared to what you were doing, which is more of a traditional style?
Yeah, I think we all realized that when Vince decided to go national, and he was the one that kind of, you know, broke away from the good old boy handshake regional promoters and went national, I don't think there was any question that Vince's show looked better than anybody's, looked slicker, was nicer than anybody's, but I think ours was a little bit, as you said, traditional, a little bit more raw, edgy. I think fans loved that. Not that they didn't like what Vince did, but Vince had a great polished show. And and really still does. Vince was smart enough to put a lot of money, a lot of effort into his shows and have them produced, where a lot of times we went, we produced our shows live to tape. We would go in the studios at TBS and we would take the air and we would go for 2 hours. And we would have commercial breaks and we would wait through the commercial breaks and we'd come back and they'd fade up and guys would come to the ring and we would have an angle where I was standing. And when that show was over, they had a show, a 2 hour show that they could give to the people at TBS to play that night. You know, that was kind of unheard of. Vince's shows were produced, post-produced, and had a glossy finish to them. Ours were live to tape. Whatever happened that day, you saw that night.
And while his looked, you know, it looked polished, like you said, but at the same time, there was something to the show that was raw and had this real feeling about it. Like, because what you were pitching wasn't, you know, sports entertainment, obviously. This is wrestling. This is a sport at the time. And right. To have that kind of raw feeling and do it the way you did, that's the presentation that I grew up on. Maybe it's just a thing from being here in the South, but to watch that and even to go back to it now, that's like when I look back, you know, at the wrestling I grew up on, I still love that, you know, because of that raw feeling it gave you.
Well, and that's true. And for the fans that grew up in the Northeast, there were some great things that happened up there as well. I don't know if you ever saw the angle between Larry Zbysko and Bruno Sammartino.
Yeah.
That's one of the great angles in wrestling. And that was done back in the old days when it was, you know, live to tape and raw in its format. You know, Vince moved away from that and wanted to have something that would appeal not only to the fans, but he wanted to have something that would appeal to program directors and station managers, that they would want that product on their TV station because it was slick. It looked better. But I agree. We were, those were some wonderful times and we did some crazy things and some of the angles, some of the interviews that we did are memorable stuff.
I wanted to bring some of that up. I was going to say, because you've got Ric Flair and then you've got the Four Horsemen and they're getting plenty of TV time every week and they should, but I'm sure you're standing there and every week it's just, I'm going to introduce this guy or the group and just see where they take us for the next 3 or 4 minutes.
Right.
What was that experience like? Because you're sitting there going, I'm just going to wind them up and let them go.
Yeah. But friends of mine, family members would say, did you get to interview so-and-so this week when you were down in Atlanta? And I would say, listen, I don't interview anybody. Okay. I don't ask any questions. I just say, here they are, Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen. Or here he is, Magnum TA. Or now the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. And that's all I would do. And I would just sit there and wait for an angle to happen. And many times I didn't know what was going down. Or most of the time I didn't know what was going down. But then again, it came across as a real sporting event because a real sports announcer would not know what's going on with the team. During the course of a game, they would react to home runs. They would react to touchdowns. They would react to great baskets at the buzzer. I would react to angles off the cuff. And it was wonderful back then.
Was there any, an interview or a couple, whether it was from Flair, the Horsemen, or from others that really stood out?
Yeah, I remember, the first one I remember was, I did one with, I think Paul Jones, and he had Abdullah the Butcher. And Abdullah the Butcher put my tie in his mouth. And as as Paul is doing the interview, he's chomping on my tie, getting closer and closer to my neck. I just thought that was tremendous. When they went to black and he took my tie out of his mouth, he turned to me and said, send me the bill for the dry cleaning on that. And it's like, you know, I was thinking, shoot, man, I got Abdullah Butcher slobber all over my tie. I'm not going to clean it. I remember doing an interview for the first Starrcade with Roddy Piper. And Roddy faced Greg Valentine in a dog collar match in the first Starrcade in 83. And we did a promo for the Greensboro Market. It was about a 2.5 minute promo or interview with Roddy Piper talking about, and I would run down the card for the Greensboro Coliseum Starrcade 83, a Flair for the Gold, Flair against Harley Race, all the other matches. And I brought in Roddy Piper. He had the dog collar. He hooked me to the dog collar and drug me back and forth as he was doing the interview. And then after it was over, he said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yes." I didn't know he was going to do that, but it was wonderful. So I remember that one. I remember on TBS when Magnum TA belly-to-bellied Ric Flair in the middle of the ring and took the world title belt and came to me and said, "You tell Flair, I'm not getting the words right. You tell Flair, I don't want this way. I'll beat him in the ring for it." And then Flair came out of the ring. You know, he was all embarrassed and probably had his suit torn off and was looking for his world title belt and grabbed at me. It was shaking me, from what I remember. May not be that correct, but where's my title belt? And I said, "Here it is, Rick. Magnum wanted you to have it." And that's when I remember.
Yeah.
I remember Dusty Rhodes and the gorilla. And he had a gorilla, somebody in a gorilla suit in a cage.
Yeah.
I remember that one very
well. I remember when the Road Warriors jumped Dusty and put the spike in his eye.
Yeah, I remember that too. Yeah. And I remember Ric Flair kissing a mannequin.
Yes.
Because he was in love with Precious and Jimmy Garvin's Precious. It was just, you know, and he is a nut.
Oh, yeah. You know what the funny thing is that I know it's not exactly the most technical, obviously, match, but I don't know why, but there's some things, you know, that in your life that just really stand out when you talk about that angle with Precious. That match between right. Flair and Jimmy Garvin in the cage, Precious versus the title, you know, on the line. For whatever reason, I love that match. It's like hard to like find the entire match, but it's, I mean, all they did was chop each other, beat the hell of each other, and Jimmy just sold his knee so great, and just how the crowd, the fever pitch of it, what was on the line, and just the right. way that they just beat the ever loving crap out of each other in that match. It was just
right.
It's just something that stood out to me. It still does. I love that match for whatever reason.
Well, it's the storyline was great. The guys could work. They made you want to see that match. It's a classic example of how angles work. And, you know, if you go back and you watch that match in its entirety, you may think, well, it's not as good as I thought it was, or you may think it's better, but you know, back then it was just wonderful.
Yeah.
To watch that.
Because you were around Rick so much and got to call, you know, not only work with him on the show on TBS, but also call so many matches. How many times have you seen Ric Flair's bare ass?
Oh, more times than I like to count.
Right.
You know, Ric Flair loves showing it to everybody. And it got to where it was like, okay, next. I saw it a lot. And, you know, he was, God, there was never a better fun-loving, everybody crowd around him, everybody would, you know, would gravitate to him, a fun-loving, really nice person to be around like Ric Flair. I mean, when you were with Ric Flair, he bought everything, and that was probably not right, but that's the way it was. And you wanted to be around him. I wanted to be around him not because I was a Ric Flair fan growing up, but because I loved him. And I loved Arn and Tully and all those guys, and they were just fun to be around. And he was a very, very warm and generous person. And we talk now and then, but don't talk as much as we should. I mean, he lives here in Georgia somewhere.
Yeah.
We got him out to one of our Gwinnett Braves games, and we talked and had a good time, but I haven't really talked to him that much as of late. But to answer your question, Ric Flair's bare ass is old hat.
Yes.
It's like looking at a wall. You see it every day. It doesn't affect you anymore.
Because you were a fan, but obviously this is a job that you were doing and you're working with so many different talented people. Was it ever tough to stay in the moment and say, "Hey, you know what? I'm wild." You can get lost in it because of what you're seeing, especially when they're cutting these promos and everything, and you're standing right there. Or was it tough to keep focus in that moment when that was going on?
No, it was never tough. I always knew what my job was. I mean, I always knew that my job was to put these guys over to make them seem bigger than life, to make them seem like great athletes. I used to kid with some of the guys sometimes, and I can't remember who I said this to, but I probably said it to many of them. I said, I've got the toughest job in the world. And they say, why? I said, I'm making a bunch of freaking drunks look like athletes. And they would all laugh. But I knew my job. I as I guess The Rock would say, I knew my role. And I never varied from that. I thought I was part of all this. And so I never varied from that.
You know, it's funny because your job at the time, you know, I don't want to say it was simple, but it was, you know, you knew the role, like you said, and it was make these guys look good. You set them up and you let them do their thing. And, you know, wrestling for good or for worse, wherever you want to put it. And I know everybody has their own opinion about this, but it seems like such an easy formula with something like that, that wrestling has gone away from. And I know it's a different day and age and there's so many different things that are scripted now, but I still wonder to some extent, you know, when it comes to WWE or whoever, if they would ever go back to something like that, because it puts the emphasis back on the talent to go out there and put themselves over and have the announcers just kind of, okay, we know our role. We're going to make you look good and we're going to hand it over to you and let you take it from there.
Well, a couple of things. Television has changed so much from back in those days. You know that.
Yeah.
Because of all the different reality shows and all the different cable channels that are out there now and all the things that you can watch without even watching the show as it happens. You know, we DVR a lot of stuff and we watch a lot of things on Netflix here at the house. That time we'll never have that time again because of that. And also because I think what you're seeing now is a case of, and this is not a slight on Vince and what he does at all, but you know, he is, he really micromanages. And he really wants stuff done the way he's done. He wants it without letting the guys do their thing. So I can't see it going back to the old days because entertainment on TV is a lot different. I mean, the focus now on the WWE is all on their network now.
Right.
So.
You know, when it comes to the network too, because obviously the shows that you were a part of are now on the network. Are you finding like some new fans? Do you find anybody that says, hey, you know, I didn't, you know, watch this at the time, or I was too young to watch it at the time, but now I'm going back and watching these shows on the network and I'm getting to know Tony Schiavone.
Well, I've heard some stories. One of the ESPN broadcasters, Sean Farnham, one of the color guys on ESPN basketball, big wrestling fan. His kids are starting to now watch the old Nitro stuff and learn exactly who I am. But as far as other people saying it, I haven't really heard much of that because I've kind of stayed away from it. I've been doing baseball, basketball, football, and some other things that I've kind of gone my other way. But I can tell you this, people in the broadcasting industry will know who I am.
Absolutely.
At the radio station where I started to work, the sports talk, all the guys know who I am. A lot of the athletes remember all the stuff. So in the sports world that I work with, in the broadcast media world, there's a lot of people know because a lot of them grew up watching that stuff. And again, back then in the 80s, you know, TBS was one of the dominant cable channels. It's not like that anymore.
Right. You know, and you mentioned, you know, you stopped watching because you had other things going on in your life, for work and personally as well. WWE had offered you a deal when they bought WCW, would you have continued your broadcasting career in wrestling?
Oh yeah, I would have, because the money was too good. I couldn't leave it alone. My friend, Eli Gold, who's the play-by-play voice of Alabama football.
Yes, he is.
Longtime friend of mine told me one time, he said, it's called the old golden handcuffs. You'd like to break away, but you just can't. And that's what it was. I was tied to it. I was making a great living. I had five kids. I had a lot of bills because I had five kids. And I didn't want to stray from that. So I would have gone to the WWE, no doubt about it. of course, I don't know what they would have offered, but I would have stayed on doing that. Because, you know, again, contrary to what some of the people out there have heard, thought, or talked about, I loved wrestling and still do.
Yeah. Do you think?
But I like it. Yeah. I like it the way it was, not the way it is.
Right, and I can. Absolutely, it does, because that's what you did, and that was the wrestling that you grew up on, that you enjoyed even before you got into the business. And I know the last couple of years for WCW, we'll say, were challenging to say the least for you. Right. But did that experience keep you away from even watching wrestling after you left the business, or was it just, I've got other things I've got going on?
That was a combination of both, but you're right. The bad experiences we had at WCW, and it's not anybody's fault. I can't point to one person to say, but it was very taxing and very tiring. And people ask me sometimes, the last Nitro, what was going through your mind? And I say it was relief. I didn't know if I was going to go to the WWF or WWE. I didn't know what... there was some worry in my mind about that, but I was glad to get this over with because of how taxing it was. And that was one of the reasons I stopped watching it, because I'd had enough of it. And I think I'm on it. Being very honest, I think my commentary showed that he'd had enough of this stuff. Eric even took me off one time for a couple of weeks and put Scott Hudson on, because Eric said, "You're getting burned out on all this stuff." And he was right.
I was going to say, how taxing was your schedule? Because at one point you're doing Nitro, then they expand Nitro to a longer show, and then they add Thunder. I mean, you're doing, 5 hours of live television per week, plus other things, I'm sure, behind the scenes.
Yeah, I'm producing the Saturday Night Show, which, of course, when Nitro came aboard, Saturday Night, went down in, I don't know, popularity, but certainly did not become our primary show anymore. I produced that. I produced WCW Worldwide. We would, let's say that we had a pay-per-view on Sunday. On Saturday, we would fly to that town, do the pay-per-view on Sunday. They would have an arena that was close by where we could all drive to do Nitro. Let's say we would do a pay-per-view in Charlotte, and then we would have Nitro at the Smith Center in Chapel Hill. We would drive after Nitro, after the pay-per-view, to Nitro, do Nitro that night. Then we would fly back to Atlanta. I would work in the office on Tuesday, and then Wednesday I'd work in the office. And then on Wednesday night we'd fly somewhere, because we would have Thunder Live on Thursday. And then I would fly back home Friday morning, and pretty much I had the weekends to myself, which was pretty cool, unless there was a pay-per-view. So we flew back and forth, and then, of course, when the budget started getting tight, they started taping Thunder, on Tuesday. So we had Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and then fly home on Wednesday, and we're home for the rest of the time. So I did have a lot of time with my kids, and I made a lot of time for my kids. I really did. Eric got on me about that a lot of times, about making time for my kids, but I did. But it was a monotonous schedule, but again, I'm this type of person that says, only thing I'm doing is flying to an arena and talking for a living. I'm not waking up in the morning and going out and digging a ditch.
Yeah.
So I never like to portray what I did as hard work or tough work, because it was in reality, if you take everything together, it was fun. The end of it was not, but overall, my career was fun.
When did you start feeling the pressure that came with the job from a standpoint of everything that came on with Monday Night Wars, because you're still having fun, you're calling wrestling, you're with a company that, beat Vince McMahon for more than a year straight. But was there a specific time when you started to feel a lot of pressure because of how big that war was?
Well, I can just remember sometimes me doing a pay-per-view, 2 hours and 46 minutes or whatever it was, then going doing a Nitro, and then going doing a Thunder, because they had me do Thunder too eventually. And I can remember my voice just giving out on me. And I remember thinking, and I even had a doctor tell me, he said, if you keep putting a strain on your voice, it's not going to be with you as long as you want it. I remember during that time where my voice was hoarse and everything, thinking that, if I want any longevity doing this, it may not be announcing. It may be doing something else. It may be producing or something behind the scenes. I can't remember exactly what time that was, but that had to be, I would think, around 2000, the year before we went down.
Yeah.
About that time.
Was it around that time where, was it, or was around that time when maybe you thought, you know what, I'm starting not to like my job because of what's going on here.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of things, especially when, and I understand, listen, I understand how hectic it was backstage. And we went and shot a movie, Ready to Rumble, and I spent a whole month in Los Angeles, and I saw how they did a movie. And it was hectic doing a movie. So anytime you have something entertainment, there's always changes and there's always a lot of things going on and rewrites, and it happens in the industry. And I understand that. But there was so much hectic going on backstage, I would set calling the match with my headphones and I would say a line. I don't know, talk about this guy. I would say something about this guy and a certain angle. A minute later, Terry Taylor was on the headset telling me what to say. I had just said it. And I remember thinking, you know, this is terrible. And I told Terry during the commercial break, I said, Terry, I just said that. And he said, well, he had his headset off and he was talking to a wrestler about their angle, about what they're going to do. He didn't have a chance to listen to me all the time, but he was going to lend his 2 cents, which I appreciate. I really do. But I told Terry, I said, if you're going to produce me, then you listen to everything that I say. And so, and he wasn't the only one that did that. There was a couple other guys in the backstage that would tell me what to say that I had just said. There was nobody that was on a headset to produce me completely. And that got to be very taxing for me. And I knew that, man, we're really going downhill.
What was that chaos like when you're the guy that's out there, you're conveying the product to the audience, and there's so much stuff that's going on behind the scenes. Some of it I'm sure you're probably starting to steer clear of, or you don't even know about, but there's so much going on. And then you're out there and you're trying to do a job front and center. And there's some times where nobody even has like a sheet of what they're going to do for the night. I mean, things maybe are happening on the fly. I mean, what's that process like?
Well, I remember a couple of times it happening and I was very upset, but then I got to thinking, and rightfully so, you know, I'm helping make this disorganized thing come across very well. So I would see it as a challenge. I remember going to backstage sometime and laughing. I'd say, I dare you not to give me a format the entire night. I dare you. I said, just tell me in my ear what's coming up next. I said, we'll make it work. So after a while, it kind of got to be a challenge, and it didn't bother me. At first, it bothered me, but then again, as I said, you know, we're making this thing work, even though things are chaotic in the back. And again, it's just like a movie and all the rewrites they have. You know, Eric said, rightfully so. He said, we can't not do what we think is a great idea because we're in the process of doing something else. If it's a great idea, we got to go for it. And that's what they did. They would, hey, why don't we do this? Well, we're 3 segments into the show. Well, we'll do it. And we're going to do this. And you do this. And you do this. Oh, by the way, here's a new format. Take it out to him. So there you go.
You know, there's been so many different nostalgia shows over the years. Has anybody ever contacted you and others about doing like a WCW show? Like just a one night only or anything like that?
No, I don't think so. You mean like doing a television show or like doing a...
Oh, or anything. I mean, how many times have we seen these different ECW nostalgia shows or whatever? You know, I was just curious if anybody had ever said, hey, you know what? We want to do a WCW one for one night.
I mean, I've done some... I did the NWA Fan Fest in Charlotte, the Mid-Atlantic one. I'm going to be at... WrestleCon, and I'm starting to do more shows now, working into my schedule.
Yeah,
because it's pretty obvious that, you know, there's a one for the nostalgia. But as far as you being an announcer, I'm going to be honest with you, Brian, I don't want to do it anymore. Conrad told me, he said, I want you to do an intro like you used to do in Nitro for this show. I said, Conrad, I don't have that in me anymore. I don't, I can tell you right now, I don't know where that is in me. So I'd rather not do it. So we don't do it. We always sign off now and saying, you know, always say, "We're desperately out of time," or something like that. And Conrad's got a chair, or something like that. Tape machines are rolling. But as far as the hype of the Monday Nitro open, I don't know if I really have that in me anymore. Because that was kind of the thing that, you know, the crowd, the excitement, and the countdown all lended to that excitement that came out of my voice. I don't know if I can bring that back in just a setting in a studio.
When it comes to you and Conrad doing the podcast, and obviously you guys go into detail on a particular subject on each one, is it a situation where you can remember everything, or do you ever have to go back and kind of, you know, jog the wheel a little bit to remember some different things that he's going to bring up?
Oh, we're talking about, all right, our podcast, our third podcast is going to be on the very first Nitro. And that was 1995. So you see how long ago that was.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to go on the network and go back and watch it to remember some of that stuff. Now, I didn't do the commentary on that. I really didn't do that much backstage on that because I wasn't a producer of Nitro. I have to go back and remember some of this stuff. We did our second podcast was NWO Sold Out. And he said it was the worst podcast ever. I mean, the worst pay-per-view ever. I went back and watched it, not remembering it. And then all of a sudden I realized, well, I'm not doing the commentary on that. That's why I don't remember it.
Yeah.
And those big shows, I was not a producer on. I had to go back and watch it. And, you know, they were right. It was terrible.
There was some bad stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it's easy. It's not easy now here, 22 years later, being a Monday morning quarterback. It's so easy. I hate doing that, but. You know,
right.
They want to hear my opinion, so I give it to them.
And there's a lot of things that even in the past that I, you know, at the time I go, man, I love that. And then I go back and I go, why did I love that so much? Or it's the opposite. Somebody was like, maybe I didn't appreciate that much as I should have. You know, I didn't realize how good it was at that time. So that's easy to
Here's one of the reasons too. It was too much of it.
Yeah.
There was too much stuff going on. I mean, I remember Eric saying, they want us to do a show, live show on TBS, but I'm going to tell them we can't do it. And unless Ted Turner says we're doing it, we're not going to do the show. Well, apparently Ted Turner said we're doing it. And so Thunder came out, and it was just too much. It was way too much Tony Schiavone for anybody to handle, and way too much wrestling. And it just, the more you have, the less you do.
Well, the funny thing is, I think we can, there's a lot of people right now, and I'm one of them, that says WWE is doing too much when it comes to Raw and SmackDown. And you have to think about this, that during this period, you know, when the Monday Night War was going on, imagine that and then double it, because you not only had it for WWE, but you also had it for WCW as well.
Right. I know. And, so you water down your product. I remember Greg Gagne told me, we were playing golf one day before an event that we had. Greg worked with us for many years in the backstage. I liked Greg. Greg said, we got to back this stuff down. He said, we got to give them less. He said, I know that no one will do that. He said, but that's the only way it can work. He said, you give them less, less, and less, and then you slowly give them more. Because they'll let you give them less, they want more. He was right about that. And I just, I remember that talk that we had. But of course, we never did. We just kept giving them more and more and more until, guess what? They had seen everything.
Right.
There's nothing more to give you.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier the WWE Network. Has WWE asked you to come in and do any work for that or voice anything for specific projects?
Yeah, they contacted me. What year was it? Well, years get away from me. I guess in 2013, maybe 2012, to voice over, come in and do a sit-down interview about the Monday Night Wars. And they've got this thing on their network called the Monday Night Wars.
Yeah.
And they had me come in and do some, and they brought me in, flew me in. My son lives in New York City. They got to see him and they went over and spent the night in Stanford. And went over, and it was on a Monday, so I think most people were out doing Raw. And stayed there all day and did some on-camera stuff. They paid me for it, and I left. But that's the only – they had contacted me earlier And I'm thinking about maybe, I don't know, 2007 or something. And they contacted me early. It was even probably earlier than that. And I remember because I was at a Braves game and I was covering the Braves, and they called me, and it was a Stamford, Connecticut call, and I took it. And they said they were going to do some videos and talking about the history of Starcade. And they said, David Crockett's on board, so-and-so's on board, and would you do it? I said, no, I'm not. I said, but, you know, my best to Kevin Dunn and everybody because of the way my schedule was. But I did it that time. I remember thinking, boy, I don't think Vince wants to have me there. But Vince had nothing to do with it. You know, his company is so big now that I don't know how much he oversees.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about something. I know a fan had asked you, I can't remember exactly when, but somebody had asked you about on Twitter about you ever going into the Hall of Fame, and you made a comment about how you thought you were blacklisted by WWE and Vince McMahon. Any particular reason why you feel that way?
Well, I left after 1 year there, and I think he was very upset with me for leaving. I shouldn't have left. It was a terrible mistake to leave, but I made a decision based on what my family needed at that time. I always thought he was angry with me for that. I know we talked after that, and he was very nice to me, but I just always got the feeling that me leaving really, really ticked him off. So I may be wrong, but, and again, here's another thing. I think going into the Hall of Fame would be great. I think the guys who are in there deserve it, but I think there are many more wrestling announcers that should go in the Hall of Fame before me. Bob Cottle, Lance Russell, Ed Caprell, Freddie Miller, and I'm sure some of the guys that did the old Clash Championship Wrestling, those guys were the pioneers of putting guys over. Those guys need to be in there before me, and I appreciate everyone saying you should be in the Hall of Fame, but, you know, there's much more to life than that. Put the guys who deserve it, and then if they want me, then maybe so.
So I don't know how much.
It's not a big deal to me, and I don't want to discount anything. JR and Gordon Solie deserve to be the first two announcers ever in there because they have been the best. But after that, nah, it doesn't bother me.
I don't know how much wrestling you're watching these days, but when you do watch wrestling, are you able to watch it as a fan like the rest of us, or do you still watch it as an announcer or somebody that was in the business?
I watch it as somebody who's in the business.
Yeah.
I watch it and try to see if they're telling the story, try to imagine, you know, them working with an agent backstage, and, you know, I watch it, you know, being a guy who was in the business, not as a fan anymore.
Yeah, and it's tough to kind of, you know, go back to that. I mean, once you've been in it, especially for as long as you did it, I can't imagine trying to turn that off.
No, and there's one thing that was true that's true today, and I haven't watched that much, but I did watch the Royal Rumble. One thing that was true that is true today that was true back then. You can tell the guys when they are in the ring. You can tell the guys who are going to be good or going to be stars, and you can tell the guys who aren't going to be stars. There's just some guys got that thing and some guys don't. And, you can tell, I mean, you could just absolutely tell.
So last thing, when it comes to the podcast, is there one particular topic or period you're looking forward to discussing that stands out?
Yeah, I'd like to discuss my relationship with Bobby Heenan. I'd like to discuss my relationship with Jim Ross. I'd like to discuss the old Crockett days. I'd like to discuss like what you and I have discussed about being a fan. And I'd like to discuss the last Nitro. Those are the things that stand out to me. From the time the first Nitro aired in 95 until the last Nitro aired in 2001, some of it's a blur to me. It really is. But there are a few moments that stand out. And to be able to just pick out a pay-per-view and say, we're going to talk about this, I'm going to have to scramble and jog my memory and look things up. So
yeah, I'd have to look it up too. How is your relationship with Bobby and with JR?
Love JR. We've been always been very good friends, regardless of what's been written about us. Bobby and I had some tough times, which were my fault, not his. I was being a company guy instead of being a friend. Bobby and I mended our discord in Cincinnati. I'm thinking in maybe 2004, 2005. And I remember him saying, and this is before he's had all his surgery and everything. I remember him saying, give me a call, stay in touch. Cause he wanted that from his friends. And I said, okay. And I never did. Never called him. And then of course he had his surgery and all the health problems he's had. So I'm sure because I've never called him, he's really mad at me. But I don't know. So, but he was wonderful to work with. They all were wonderful to work with. You know, I can even remember working with Kevin Sullivan, with Dutch Mantel, you know, work with everybody, but they were all wonderful to work with.
Everybody can listen to Tony's podcast now with Conrad Thompson, part of MLW Radio. What Happened When drops every Monday. I really appreciate the time, Tony, and glad to hear you back, you know, in the wrestling broadcast world, I guess, and continued success with the podcast.
Thanks, Brian. And don't forget, we're on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartPlay, on just about every platform. And don't forget that they can vote, our listeners can vote on what they want next week's topic to be on at WHW Monday on Twitter.
Thanks again to Tony Schiavone. Everybody can follow him on Twitter. It's at Tony Schiavone 24. Tony is the guy that I grew up with when it comes to wrestling. I started watching in the mid-80s. I think the first match that I ever saw, or at least the first match I ever remember seeing, was the NWA television champion, Tully Blanchard, going to a 10-minute time limit draw against Brad Armstrong, watching that on a Saturday night on the Superstation. And Tony was the guy that was calling the match. And that's right in my wheelhouse. That's my area where I grew up and watching the NWA. And Tony was a big, big part of that. So I really enjoyed listening to him there and the work that he did. And even in later years when he did WCW, I still really enjoyed Tony a lot. And it's great to know that, he is back in the wrestling business. Well, I say he's in the wrestling business, but he's back talking about wrestling. He's back doing something when it comes to wrestling. And, he's doing the podcast, What Happened When, part of MLW. And he's having success with it so far. And I think he's having a lot of fun. And that's the most important thing is he's having fun. People are enjoying the podcast as well. I'm very interested in seeing what other topics they talk about. I mean, there's just so many different things that they're going to discuss in that podcast. There's so many different directions that they can go. I have a feeling that a lot of people are going to be most interested immediately about the WCW days because people love hearing about train wrecks, or that was during the Attitude Era as well. Or not, I say Attitude Era, but that was during the Monday Night Wars. So I've got a feeling they're going to be doing a lot of talk about that originally. But when they get into the talk about NWA, Four Horsemen, Ric Flair, that entire era, I know that's going to be the spot that really piques my interest. So I'm really looking forward to that. Thanks, everybody, again, for listening. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Brian Fritz. You can follow Between the Ropes there as well, at Between the Ropes. Please subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, the TuneIn app, and on SoundCloud as well. And please rate and review the podcast, especially on iTunes. And you can also support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/betweentheropes. Anything that you feel comfortable with when it comes to supporting us monetarily there would be greatly appreciated. Just whatever you feel comfortable with. Like I said, if it's a dollar a month or more, anything that you can do to help us keep doing what we're doing would be fantastic. Michael and I will be back later on in the week to talk about what has been going on in wrestling over this past week. Looks like that will probably drop on Wednesday night. I will talk to you then right here, Between the Ropes.